Look, I'm not going to die on a hill of saying everyone has to have roadmaps. Go back to my earlier statement. If you can align your organization on a direction of travel without one, go for it. I'm not dogmatic about having roadmaps. I'm dogmatic about making sure we drive the right outcomes as a business. We align as an organization. I'm pragmatic about how we do it. Roadmaps are a tool in our arsenal. OKRs are a tool in our arsenal. Strategies are a tool in our arsenal. Vision is a tool in our arsenal. There are 100 ways of communicating vision, 100 ways of communicating strategy.
Welcome to the Scandinavian Product Podcast. My guest today is my friend Phil Hornby. Phil is probably one of the few people in the world that has seen hundreds of product roadmaps. He's the co-creator of the show Talking Roadmaps, works together with Bruce McCarthy as a product coach, and is the founder of Four Product People, where he helps product people and teams to be their best through training, coaching, and facilitation. We could have talked about anything product, really, but today we talked about all things roadmaps. Why some people hate them? Different types of roadmaps. How can roadmapping, when done well, helps us transform our organizations to become more outcome-oriented? What roadmaps are really for, tips and tricks, and more. All right, let's dive in. All right, we are live. Phil, how's it going?
Awesome, Afonso. How's things with you?
Very good, thank you. It's been a while since we've seen each other. I was so impressed, man. You've been seeing hundreds of roadmaps, if I understood correctly. You've talked with so many people around or about roadmaps, including, you know, Bruce McCarthy, whom you know, our common friend that you work with, and Marty Kagan. You've talked with all of these people. So I have to ask you, Phil, do people get roadmaps? Why do so many people still hate roadmaps?
Roadmaps feel like the problem child. They feel like they are so terribly misunderstood. People say roadmaps are bad, they're terrible, we should throw them away. Yet most strategy is bad and terrible, but no one says we should throw them away. It's like we try to fix strategy. Why don't we try and fix roadmaps? They're a useful tool in our arsenal. They're something that helps us guide and align and communicate our direction. Like, is that not valuable? It's like, I almost liken it to democracy. You know, we say with democracy that it's the worst form of government apart from everything else we've tried before. To me, roadmaps are the worst way of aligning a team on a direction of travel apart from all the other things we've tried. So let's find something better, great. But until then, I'm going to keep using them.
So where do people, what are people missing? You need to tell, enlighten us, Phil. So I have quite a few friends who tell me, like, I hate roadmaps, you know, it's just a bunch of features and dates and I can't predict the future, you know, and clearly, as you can probably hear, there's a lot of misconceptions going around. So tell us, what do people misunderstand the most when it comes to roadmaps?
They assume it's a plan. It's this perfect, exact thing that is a prediction of the future that is absolutely going to happen. Whereas really, it's a direction of travel. It's about a common journey. We all know it's not going to happen exactly as we've written down. And if we accept that and look at it from through that lens, what really is it's a point of view or a kind of a strong opinion on this is the direction we should be taking our product. These are the things we should be doing. And, you know, you mentioned features, you mentioned dates. Short answer is sometimes they're the right thing to put on a roadmap. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're not. Like a Gantt chart, sometimes is the right style of roadmap. Sometimes it's not. Like everything in product, it depends. And like it's just one of those truisms of product management. If you have a Gantt chart date-based, feature-based roadmap that is delivering great products, delivering tons of customer value, leave it alone. It's fine. If it isn't working, then we should start looking at other options. We should look at, well, do we take dates off? Or do we gradually evolve? Like, the reality is, going from a Gantt-based roadmap that most people have, or at least had, straight to a now next to later style outcome-driven roadmap in one step is too much for most people, for most organizations. You've almost got to have a roadmap for your roadmap. How are we going to evolve this thing over time?
Yeah, so that's okay. So you're touching on really interesting topics. So they assume it's a plan. That's beautiful. I totally agree with that. And especially like the danger I see is when you have future-based roadmaps with lots of dates, long into the future, I think people have this perception that, okay, this is going to happen, and all of a sudden you have sales organization that starts to promise these things to customer. In the worst case scenario, starts to sell these things. You have a whole marketing department that starts to plan campaigns for all these things that we honestly don't really know if we should even build. And then you also mentioned the now, next, later. And so for folks who are not familiar with that format, is that what you usually recommend when it comes to outcome-based roadmaps? So let's dig a bit into the different formats that you see being the most helpful for most teams.
Oh, the most helpful for most teams. It's like, let's okay. Go in on this really narrow slice.
I noticed as I said it.
So my co-host on my YouTube channel and myself, we've actually derived 12 different visuals, some of which are very non-traditional, some of which are very traditional, the Gantt chart, because it all depends on the context, depends on the audience you're communicating to, what you're trying to communicate. Are you showing uncertainty? Where I tend to favor is something that has those broad time frames of now, next, and later, maybe with some extra of current and never doing as well, because I think it's quite an important part. Because really, your roadmap's telling a story of the direction of travel. That's really what I anchor on. And then maybe we've got to start thinking about, well, what's the certainty? What's the risk? What can we put into those different time buckets? In the now, if we don't know what we're delivering now, the features, then I've got a big question mark over your organization in general. So I can probably put features there. Whereas when I get to the next and the later, in the now I'm focusing on delivery. In the next, really, I'm focusing on discovery. So I'm focusing on the problems and understanding them and evaluating the solutions. So maybe I put the problem there and the experiments that I'm running. And then we get out into the later, and it's like, this is kind of the broad problem space that we're exploring. Throughout this, you'll notice it's problem space, or as Teresa Torres would call it, the opportunity space, as Bruce McCarthy would call them, themes. Mm-hmm. Really, they are high-level statements of what are we doing for our customer? I quite like to use jobs to be done sometimes, or user outcomes. Because the reality is, sometimes when people talk about outcome-based roadmaps, they're talking about, let's put our product outcomes, like let's reduce churn on the roadmap. I'm never going to share that with a customer. A customer doesn't care about that. A customer cares about how I make their life better. So a user outcome or a job to be done is far more compelling. And, we talk about there being a lot of churn on our roadmaps, things changing. Well, customers' jobs don't change very often. So if you put those on your roadmap, actually, it tends to be a lot more stable. It tends to be something you can say, we don't know exactly how we're going to solve this job or how we're going to deliver on this outcome, but we know we're going to work on this outcome. And so we'll figure out how we solve it as we go along, what the solution is. And that kind of lack of constant churn and constant change actually makes it quite a stable roadmap, which can massively reduce the effort as well.
No, very interesting points. So you've touched on a lot of different things there that I want to pick up on. So the first thing is, so you mentioned in the now, next, later, the now should be things that you already know, you already figured out that you should be building. So these are things we know are existing problems that we want to solve. These are things that we've found a solution that is viable, desirable, usable, feasible. We've validated all of these things, and so it makes sense for us to commit to those things in the now. But yep. just so it's clear and we are on the same page, what do you mean by now? Usually, does it depend? Like, is it a quarter? Is it a month? Is it a week? Is it what do you think the now represents in terms of timeline? Because folks usually
it can vary.
Ask that.
This is one of the potential anti-patterns, even with the now, next, later. Of well, we'll say now, but what we really mean is the next 3 months. And at which point it's like, well, we've just got a time box. Mm. What I typically, in fact, I sometimes even retitle the top. It's not now, it's delivery. And it's not next, it's discovery. And it's not later, it's exploration. Sometimes I change those titles because that's what I'm doing is I'm exploring the problem space. I'm understanding the problems and the solutions, discovery, and I'm delivering against them. Because that's really what now, next, and later means. Now, next, and later is putting it in a timing context. Sometimes it's worth putting it in an activity context because the reality is things in the later you're working on right now. That you're just working on them in a different phase of the work. You're working on an understanding level as opposed to a delivery level. And that tends to be how I address it.
Interesting. Okay. So this is interesting. So the now you usually even go as far as just rephrasing delivery, but then different delivery cycles, for example, they change, like where sometimes you're just delivering something, you know, an improvement to solve a certain minor problem. Sometimes you are delivering something a bit more heavy, especially if you work with hardware, then you have a massive delivery cycle. So what you mean is, just to make sure I understood, that delivery, or in other words, that now mutates in accordance to the context you're in at that moment.
Yeah, I mean, the duration of it could be very...
Yeah, the duration of it.
Some things in there might be 1 month. Some things might be 6 months. I'll be honest, though, you mentioned hardware. So IoT is my favorite type of products. You know, when people talk about full-stack engineers, if you can't design hardware, you're not a full-stack engineer in my world. Because that's what I did as an engineer, as well as write the software. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I know full stack these days typically means back end, front end. Those sorts of complex systems where you've got hardware, software, firmware, connectivity, that complexity is what I really love. And the reality is hardware has hard timelines. So when I'm dealing with hardware, I'm more inclined to have a roadmap that is date-based. Mm-hmm. Because it makes sense. There are certain things that just have to happen that you have to work back from. And yes, it starts to conflate it with a little bit with a project plan, but you're not putting the detail of all the tasks. I typically am putting the delivery timing as opposed to the work timing. Again, that's a subtle difference. It's like, this is when these things are going to drop in this window, not we're going to work on it for the next 6 months.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I totally agree with that. With the difference between hardware and software, I think this is a problem that it's one of those. It depends that a lot of people don't understand, especially folks who have never worked with hardware, because they, you know, they get into this mantra of like, oh, there's no dates. What, you're a bad product manager? You have a date? You have a feature roadmap? What, you're not doing it right? You know, as some people would say. But then of course, like if you're dealing with hardware, you have manufacturing, you know, commitments that you have to hit. You have, you know, supply chain, procurement, all of these things that are in a lot of organizations date based, period. And that's just the commitment you have to hit. So I like that flexibility there on, you know, the differentiation between hardware and software. But if I can go back then to the now, next, later that you described, because I think there's a lot of interesting things that you said. So we're dealing with the discovery, and then you mentioned in the next, sometimes I want to see experiments, for example, for what we might be discovering, you know, next.
Yeah.
But then do you then differentiate between the outcomes you want to, or the opportunities you want to address, and the experiments you might run to validate those assumptions? Like, how do you navigate between opportunity or like problem to solve, assumptions that you want to test, and the experiments you're going to use to test them? Do you map them all in the roadmap? How does it look like for you when you're thinking about like a great roadmap.
So obviously you don't want too much detail on this thing. You're trying to keep it relatively high level. So typically the problem is always there, or the opportunity or the theme, whatever we want to call it. But if there are major experiments, major areas we're gonna work on, I think about putting them there. I think it was Daniel Elizalde, who was one of our early guests on my channel. He talks about an experiment roadmap, because fundamentally, where there's high uncertainty, that is the work that we're doing. And so let's recognize that, because one of the challenges can be that people look at the roadmap and think you're not doing anything. It looks empty if it's too high level. And it can look very empty, or it can look like you're not doing something now for the things that are coming later. Like in your next column, the reason I like to call it sometimes discovery is because that's the work I'm doing right now. But people look at it if it's just now, next, and later, and say, oh, so later we're going to do something about that. Or next we're going to do something about that is probably a better phrasing. But no, I'm working on it right now. I'm working in that dual, or I like to think of it as three track sort of mindset of I'm understanding the problem space, I'm understanding specific problems and evaluating solutions, and I'm delivering those solutions.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. So then let's see it from a different angle then. So imagine that you have like a strategy, some sort of strategy document. That a lot of people have. I'm not sure if those were actual strategies, but let's think that, you know, there's this hypothetical organization who actually has a good strategy rooted on insights and evidence from the market, from customers, from different places. There's a vision of what we want to achieve. So the theory in which we are going to achieve this vision is well described. There's a storyline there. People understand. Leaders are over communicating that, you know, kind of you start seeing it from the outside and you start seeing, okay, yeah, ticking some of the boxes that you would consider to be sort of useful, helpful. And then you have OKRs. So you have this, you have a product strategy. It's clear. You have OKRs dealing with the now, let's say, the next 3 months, you have these outcomes we want to achieve. This is how we're going to measure those outcomes. Under that circumstance, those circumstances, do you still think a roadmap would be helpful?
Yes. Short answer. Close question.
I was expecting.
Well, let me be a little bit more explicit. Roadmaps and OKRs work well, really well together. The OKRs give the product outcomes and some of the business outcomes that you are driving towards. They put a lens on top of your roadmap. Your roadmap is your belief on these are the things I'm going to do in roughly this order to achieve those outcomes. It's a statement of belief. It's a statement of direction of travel, which allows you as an organization to all align around that direction of travel. It allows you to align with your customers often on that direction of travel. If you're in B2B enterprise, you are going to have to share your roadmap, as simple as that. Anyone who thinks that they're going to get away with not sharing a roadmap in that context is lying to themselves. And so really what it's allowing you to show is that this, you know, based on these assumptions, this context, you just talked about context. Funny enough, I think that was one of my reasons why most roadmaps suck at the talk we met at. we're basically saying we have this belief that this is the right direction of travel. And do you as a customer, do you as the rest of the organization get on board with that? Are we all going the same direction? Because if we're not all going in the same direction, one, you're the wrong customer for me, and two, or we're getting it wrong for the market, and two, if we're not all on board on the same direction as an organization, we're just not going to get there.
Yeah. No, I really like the storytelling part, and I agree that roadmaps are first and foremost a storytelling tool. Some people would argue, though, that if you have a clear product strategy that is describing what we're not doing, you know, the themes we want to pursue and why, and then if that is deployed or dissected into, okay, now these are the outcomes we want to achieve, some people would argue that there is enough storytelling there. So that's what kind of Reforge, you know, they kind of rebranded the OKR into NSTs, if I'm not mistaken, like narrative, commitments, and tasks. And the narrative part is basically that. It's basically kind of the product strategy bit. So just to make sure I understood, what you're saying is that even though these things are in place, having a roadmap gives basically much more to it, to different audiences. And so it helps you engage with different audiences as well.
Look, I'm not going to die on a hill of saying everyone has to have roadmaps. Go back to my earlier statement. If you can align your organization on a direction of travel without one, go for it. I'm not dogmatic about having roadmaps. I'm dogmatic about making sure we drive the right outcomes as a business. We align as an organization. Mm. I'm pragmatic about how we do it. You know, roadmaps are a tool in our arsenal. OKRs are a tool in our arsenal. Strategy is a tool in our arsenal. Vision is a tool in our arsenal. There are 100 ways of communicating vision, 100 ways of communicating strategy. Mm. I was running a workshop for a startup or scale-up, really, last year. I had a whole plan. I was using Gib Biddle's approach to strategy, his structure, went in ready to run the workshop. The day before, I got a document from the CEO that was his expression of his thinking. And I looked and said, that's a great start, but it's a fundamentally different mental model to the one I'm bringing in. So I ripped up the workshop and started again and rebuilt it that day to be more aligned with his way of his mental model, because otherwise I was just creating extra cognitive load for everyone. What we needed to get it out of his head into a way that the team could then kick it around, refine it and improve it, but in a mental model that worked for everyone. Roadmaps are one way of representing the mental model. Heck, I consider an opportunity solution tree can be used as a roadmap, as an example. That's probably a controversial thought, but if you think about it, left to right, the opportunity space, you can order that for a headline timing. We're doing this followed by this, followed by this. Then you come down below your opportunities, you've got the solutions that you're thinking about. Okay, well, that solution, they're going left to right again underneath. Okay, that's then also sequencing. And then I've got a pile of experiments. That's a sequence again. So all of a sudden, I've got that kind of overall headline. We're going in this direction. We're doing these things to get there. Humans naturally have to do some things in an order. They have to choose the order and they have to communicate that order somehow. A roadmap is a simple way of doing that.
Yeah. I think probably one of the most important parts points that you made is that whatever you choose to use must be aligned with the mental model of your organization. In this case, maybe the CEO or the executive team. I'm not sure if you meant it precisely. That has to be aligned with some sort of leadership. If that was deliberate, or do you meant like organization culture as a whole? Those details are important.
I think I meant as a whole. In this particular case, what was evident before we started the activity with them was that the CEO was frustrated that his vision and his strategy wasn't being delivered against. Mm. But when you dug into it, he'd never communicated. He'd never got out of his head to the team. So how can they be expected to? So the mental model that existed, the only representation of it was in his head. So that's where we started, knowing full well it would evolve from there as other people got their hands on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. Okay. Gotcha. So what I think is, regardless of what you choose, because I also love what you said that, you know, you need to kind of adjust that and not only according to the mental model of the organization or the culture in general, but also what you believe will help you the most drive the outcomes you actually need to achieve. If that's OKRs with a product strategy, fine. If that's a vision, fine. If that's a North Star, fine. If that's an opportunity solution tree, by the way, I love the way you described that it can actually be seen as a roadmap too. Whatever it is, if it's a now, next, later, it has to work for your organization. But going back a few minutes, you mentioned now the now, next, later kind of rebranded in a way, sort of delivery, discovery, and exploration. I really like that because that's similar to you know, Steve Blank's and David Bland's approach to discovery and validation as well, like sort of the nuance between, in your words, discovery and exploration. It seems to me there are the same sort of the same mental model of David Bland's discovery and validation. So one, you're basically in your case, the exploration is much more vague, much more like, hey, let's understand if this is an opportunity worth pursuing. And discovery, we're actually testing assumptions and running experiments.
Yeah, I mean, did I get it right?
Or
so I think you're right. I mean, I'm going to quote Bob Mester here first. Mm-hmm. Bob would say that every 10 years, like, an existing idea has to be refreshed and rebranded to keep it relevant. And I think there's no new ideas in the sun. I've obviously read David Bland stuff. I've obviously read Steve Blank stuff, and they get remixed and so on in my head. Mm-hmm. I like the metaphor of exploration a little bit more because I think you have to go. I think I did a talk in London last year. You have to go exploring before you can discover. And thinking about the maybe a little bit too much of a colonial reference, but it's kind of that's kind of the thought process. You don't just happen to discover things. You've got to set out on that voyage. And I guess my discovery is probably almost a conflation of the discovery and validation in there. But if you take Steve Bland's work of the market discovery area, that's really my exploration.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I see. and what I think is helpful is, regardless of what you use, again, like having an idea of the outcomes you want to pursue, the problems you want to solve, the opportunities you want to tackle, however you want to see it, and then really ensure that whatever you commit is something that you validated to be, you know, viable, feasible, usable, desirable, all that jazz. In order for you to do that, you need to break down all that idea into different assumptions, and you need to run experiments to test those assumptions, and you need to show your organization somehow that you're doing that. So you need to tell a story of what you're learning. And so I guess that in the roadmap of now, next, later, if I'm doing that, you can also use it for storytelling in that sense of sharing what you're learning and the assumptions you're testing. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Although I am going to be slightly controversial, you don't need to do discovery on everything. If you have a high degree of certainty on something, you don't need to go and do discovery. You don't need to do discovery for discovery's sake. Discovery is about risk management. Discovery is about taking risk out of your product. It's like, do we know there's value there? Sometimes we absolutely do. Do we know it's viable there? Sometimes we absolutely do. Feasible, usable, ethical. Mm. If we already have the answers with a high degree of certainty, then we don't need to do an experiment. We don't need to do discovery. And David Bland would kind of explore that through assumption mapping, for example.
Yeah. I totally agree. I think the most important thing with assumption mapping is, so initially, the assumption mapping he had, confident, not confident. And then he started having workshops with executives and they started saying, yeah, I'm super confident about this. Like, yeah, just build this. I'm super confident. And then, you know, David and I think it was even with Jeff Gothoff, if I'm not mistaken, they started to realize, okay, well, confident is probably not the right word because these folks seem to be confident about everything. We need to rebrand it to evidence, and I think that's kind of the eye opener for a lot of people. It's like, okay, cognitive bias hits all the time. You sometimes think you know this stuff, and that, you know, this is we should just do this. We have enough information, But then when you phrase it as evidence, then kind of that challenges, shakes the core. Now, with that said, though, I absolutely agree that there is such a thing as too much discovery. And I do think that that's a trap that a lot of teams are falling into. So I'm really glad that you're bringing that in, because that's a very wise point. A lot of people just have this mindset that you need to discover everything, and that's absolutely not true.
I mean, so I tend to use the phrase certainty as opposed to confidence, but if we take confidence and evidence, you look at Itamar Gilad's work, and for example, his confidence meter is essentially, here's the evidence you need to gain this level of confidence. Mm. And exactly as you said, confidence is a really bad indicator of whether it's a good idea. Senior leaders are actually almost paid to be confident, which makes it almost an anti-pattern. And there was an experiment done a few years ago where someone had had their brain bifurcated, so kind of the two halves split. One half of your brain essentially does the language, kind of tells you the reasons why you made a decision. Another half of your brain makes that decision. Now, in this particular person's brain, they could not know why they made that decision because their brain was split down the middle. But when they were asked why they made a decision, they could always, with confidence, communicate why they made it. Because their brain was very good at tricking them into knowing an answer or feeling like they knew an answer with confidence.
Yeah. Exactly. Now, I think that's a super, it's a super interesting point, this whole evidence, confidence, and so on. And of course, like the you know, Itamar's work, has he been on your podcast, by the way, on the Talking Roadmaps? Nice. I have to watch that. I like the confidence meter as well. And I mean, David Bland also, of course, talks about confidence going from, I think they go from 0 to 5. But the point is, you have to get evidence to be confident. So it's kind of one is the means to the other, instead of just the starting point being the confidence itself. That's kind of the whole thesis there. But on that, though, because I think this is a really good segue on something I wanted to pick your brain on. On this confidence topic and features and kind of later in the future, I hear sometimes from startup investors and founders that some investors and some boards and so on, usually from folks that are not product or tech oriented, they want to see features and dates, even for software companies. So that's sort of a what they need sometimes to feel confident that this is a good investment. So walk me through what you're building, like exactly the things you're building in the next 3, 6 months, sometimes more. What's your advice for startup founders who may be in that situation? Like, are they doomed or can they do anything about it?
So the view I take of this is, those investors want to see a clear point of view. They want to see that you have an opinion on where you're going, on why they should invest. And right now, there's a huge kind of pushback of, I want to see an ROI on anything I'm investing in. And so I want to know what I'm investing in and what it's going to pay back. Now, I'm pretty sure these investors all know that there's a high degree of uncertainty and that plan is going to change. Mm-hmm. Having a point of view, saying, with what we know today, this is where we think we're going, I don't think it's unreasonable. And in certain industries, actually, it's probably still reasonably predictable. Like, I spent a ton of time in automotive. Car companies planning 5 to 7 year cycles. After a good meeting with someone at GM or VW, etc., I can have a pretty good idea of where they're going for quite a long time and plan for quite a long time to make sure I stay aligned with them. And there are other industries that are going to have similarities to that. Mm. Not everything. So sometimes it's about the planning horizon. Sometimes it's about saying, and maybe you can soften it slightly, like, these are the problems we know our customers are going to have and we're going to address them. And these are some of the ideas we have of how we're going to address them. They're not concrete. We still need to validate whether we can even build them, for one thing. You know, there seems to be this, there's an automatic default assumption in Silicon Valley in particular, that whatever ideas we come up with, we can make. It's all feasible. So we'll worry about feasibility later. I just don't think it's true. We're pushing the envelope. We are capable of doing more and more. But I've got a post going out later in the week that talks about a load of money I wasted in a product that I helped develop. And the fundamental thing we fell down on was feasibility. There were two fundamental parts of our products where the feasibility at a technical level, because of certain constraints, just made it not work. We couldn't deliver at the scale we needed to take advantage of the market.
Mm.
We spent all the time, we validated the value, we validated it was viable. Clear message there, worked. It was good. We took the textbook approach. We had the answers. And we just assumed we could build it. And then that's what went wrong. And that had a knock-on effect from a usability perspective, which stopped people being able to really use it and get the value.
Mm. That's interesting. I love that case because, you know, it's usually, as you said, it's usually like not a problem. In a lot of organizations, of course, especially Silicon Valley-wise, you have all sorts of resources.
But some things are just really hard problems to solve. And some things are impossible problems to solve.
Yeah. No, so what I liked about what you said with regards to the investor part and the startup part, that, you know, instead of just having a bunch of features that they want to hear and they want to see, focus on the problems that you want to address, that you know exist because you talked with lots of people, and present a few ideas that could potentially solve those problems, but you don't really know which one you're going to focus on. I think that is an interesting, that would do it, basically, I would argue. However, though, so let's take the same case. Let's go back into a more corporate world again. Is it the case that sometimes, you know, when you have a roadmap and you have a caveat in the bottom saying, you know, all these ideas, or it's like, we don't know if this is going to happen. And then just, is it the case that salespeople don't read at those caveats or just close their eyes? Or does it work to add caveats, or does it not? Because I've heard, for example, Marty Kagan says it doesn't work, but other people says it works. Where what's your opinion on that?
So the so-called disclaimer, in fact, at a previous job at Trimble, we literally had an entire page that was a safe harbor statement that said, don't make any decisions based on this forward-facing statement. We were a publicly traded company, and there are certain limits that come in because of that particular reason around revenue recognition and things like that. But I think it helps to frame the conversation, having something down there. Like one of my friends who was also on the podcast a while ago, he, instead of writing subject to change, best before, etc., he writes at the bottom, we embrace change. Essentially, he takes a mindset or a principle from the Agile Manifesto and puts that at the bottom instead of trying to write legalese to weasel out of things. It's like, this is our best guess right now, but we embrace change. You know it's going to evolve. We know it's going to evolve. But this will help us have a conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. No, I like that. And I think that the challenge I hear sometimes is people, you know, product people who argue that, you know, I had the Now Next Later, for example, and I was very careful on the caveats that, you know, whatever is on the next in terms of, even in terms of outcomes, like we're going to solve this problem or we're going to tap into this theme or whatever. Even those, you know, we might, you know, we're not sure. And then all of a sudden they make a decision to pivot to something else or to target to solve a different problem. And they get this, you know, massive pressure from sales saying, what the hell, what are you doing? I thought that blah, blah, blah. It's like, didn't you read the caveat? And most of the time they don't, in the stories I hear. Other times, I mean, they do. I've experienced with one caveat in a roadmap and everything was okay. I mean, but, you know, you hear these stories all the time.
Sometimes the salespeople even delete the caveat. They if they get an editable file, if you send them a screenshot, one of the things that
crop.
Yeah, they crop. If you put it at the bottom, it's a crop. I think it's Rich Mironoff's favorite approach is to make it a violator. A violator is where you put it as a like a watermark across the middle, so that it's impossible to delete.
Yeah, I see. That's hilarious.
Yeah, it's,
I love that.
I mean. The interesting thing on this one is I found salespeople are the people who really push back the hardest and have the biggest problem here. The customers are usually pretty chill about it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I agree. And you even mentioned before in the beginning of the conversation that, you know, roadmaps is a storytelling tool. And if it helps you tell a story to a certain audience, then, you know, then use it. And I do think that in some cases you need to tweak the story, in other words, the roadmap, for sales, for example. So the roadmap you present to the whole product organization, you know, different platform teams, different streamline teams or empower product teams, depending on terminology, that roadmap might be different than the roadmap you present to marketing and sales, for example. Is that something you've seen? Is that something you recommend usually? Like basically adjusting your roadmap based on audience.
So funnily enough, I don't call this changing the roadmap. I call this creating different views. I'm at generally five different Very views, nice. But it's one roadmap. And I'm creating something for the specific audience to communicate what they need to know about, what's relevant and important to them. Now, I've got about five typical views that I work with, but we've actually created a roadmap audience canvas to help explore what each audience needs. It's essentially a persona, because really the roadmap you can look at as a product that's serving a particular persona, and we're rendering it for that audience. If we're dealing with development and operations, they want detail short-term because they don't believe anything long-term. If we're dealing with execs, we want long-term light on the detail. If we're dealing with customers, we want mid-range time, relatively high level, and not necessarily all the internal detail. And in fact, if I'm dealing with customers in a sales cycle, well, we said now, next, and later. I actually prefer to put current, now, and next. I don't worry about later, it's too far out. But current is, you can have this value today. Let's stop talking about delaying the purchase until we've done something in the next column. Let's have all this value today, and you know this is all coming. And so we shift the time frame, we shift the window that they're looking at to communicate what they care about. And like my five typical views are kind of sales and development and operations, the people who actually need to deliver it and operate it, execs or senior leadership, which maybe go to investors, customers, prospects, because they are subtly different. I have more trust of a customer than I do a prospect, frankly, which is almost counterproductive, because the prospects, you almost need to show them more to build the trust. But then there's also partners. So there's people outside my organization that I'm working with that need to know my direction of travel to work with me.
I really like that. It's the same roadmap, different views, different ways to look at it.
Yeah.
I love that. So where can people read more about this, Phil? Is it an article you wrote? Or
The best place would be to jump onto talkingroadmaps.com. We are literally in the process of writing a bunch of different visual guides. I talk about this in many of the episodes when we talk to guests as well. But yeah, it's the Talking Roadmaps is probably the best place to start.
Cool. Awesome. All right, let's move on to our last topic, unless we go on a rant and then more topics unfold. Last topic, product leadership and product teams. So I hear some people asking about how product leadership should collaborate with product teams when it comes to crafting the roadmap. And you had a point in your talk that people focus too much on roadmaps, less on roadmapping and the activity of roadmapping. Can you tell us a little bit more about What does great look like when it comes to road mapping together regarding product leadership and product teams? How should people work together? What's important and so on?
Ooh, right. So I'm going to quote Marty Kagan for a second. Empowered product teams don't need less leadership. They need better leadership. Yeah. And by that, it means we get out of the way of the detail, but we make sure the problems are clear that we want the organization to deliver against. We make sure the outcomes are clear so that the team can then go and deliver against them. And in road mapping, I use the term road mapping, but really what I mean is doing the work of product management. It's making the decisions. Like, product management is constant decision making about the direction of the product. And I don't necessarily mean it's the product manager making the decision. Generally, I consider product is fundamentally a team sport. Most decisions need to be made by the team themselves as an overall unit. But there's going to be a product manager driving certain decisions. There's going to be a technical lead driving other ones. There's going to be a designer driving other ones. And they all kind of have to coalesce together to make a successful product. But leadership need to make sure that frame is there, that context is there, so that people know what is important to be able to deliver against it. If that context is missing, then everyone's going to be going off in different directions. Unless you've got one team that's only going one direction, that's going to just be suboptimal in terms of outcomes, because you're going to be driving different things in different directions. Mm. And to me, road mapping, as I say, It's that sport of making all those choices. I've said at a number of talks, if you're spending more than 30 minutes on your roadmap a month, you're getting it wrong. And because what I really mean by that is, if you're spending more than 30 minutes on the artifact, then you've probably not done the work beforehand to be able to do it easily. If you've done the work as a team, you've made those decisions, you know where you're going, that's a trivial thing.
Mm-hmm. I really like that point. And it's the same with, for example, OKRs. When I hear people screaming about, oh my God, we spent like 2 weeks trying to figure out, the objectives and the key results. And every time a new sort of OKR cycle comes up and people roll their eyes and it's like, oh my God, not again. That's just a clear sign that people they have no clue what they're doing. They have no clue about what they should be building, to whom, and for which outcome to solve. And I'm not blaming the teams, by the way. This is a product leadership area. It's, as you said very wisely, teams need a context. And so the product leaders really need to step up and provide that context and have those conversations with the teams, which, in some, what I would say, healthy environments would turn into a more like a negotiation between teams and product leaders to really define what those outcomes should be, how we're going to measure those outcomes, what we're going to focus on now, what we're going to focus on next, what might be later according to the vision we want to solve. And that's, a beautiful story that more teams and leaders should be telling.
So Marty Kagan would say that leaders need to assign or decide on the problems. I'm a little bit hesitant of that. What I really want is almost leaders to approve the problems, because the reality is the teams are there on the ground discovering or exploring and finding those problems. Then they bring them back and say, these are the things that we think are worth working on that will move the needle. We recommend that we work on X and Y, but ultimately, and this is an unpopular opinion, ultimately leadership's job is to decide. And so we can recommend, but someone ultimately has to make that decision. And unless they've fully pushed down decision-making, it's going to be the leader. But we put our case together. There's a simple human step. Whenever I'm asking for a decision by a leader, I literally write or say, I recommend we do X because of Y. And that simple statement of saying you recommend it makes you about 90% more likely to get that outcome, because you've actually expressed your opinion as opposed to saying, here are the three things we should do. What do you think?
I think that's a really interesting point. So, yes, I think Marty Kagan is very kind of strong advocating that point of like team objectives should be assigned. That's basically the word, right? He uses. And I do agree with you that in a lot of cases, it's a bit of, you can see it from different ways, but I think going back to almost the first thing you said, it depends a lot. Because, you know, some teams that are more junior than others. So a more junior team, for example, would probably appreciate some outcomes being assigned and then having that conversation. Some more senior teams would probably appreciate more like, hey, can you dig into this, into the outcomes we should probably focus on next? And then the leader is there to give feedback and to coach these people. But then it also depends a lot on the product leader. Like if this person has been a product manager in that company for a while, for example, you know, explored those problems a lot, has learned a lot, and then eventually, you know, is a great people person, knows how to coach different teams, knows how to lead, set context, all of that jazz, became a, you know, a product leader. In that circumstance, you know, it might be interesting to do both as well, to kind of have a more collaborative dynamic. So I think it depends a lot, as you said before, and I think your point is very valid that some teams should take more ownership, but sometimes it's a bit of a chicken and the egg. The leaders don't provide enough context. So it's back to Marty Kagan's point of like empowerment requires better management, not less management.
I love your point about maturity of the team. So there's a concept in management called situational leadership, which by a guy called Blanchard. And in there, you have different phases of maturity of your people coming into the team. And at one point, it is a very directive way of leading or of managing that's expressed as the need. And with a very junior team, they're probably told the problem to solve and even the solution to go and to work on. You know what? Not necessarily the end of the world. Mm-hmm. I might say you have to go exploring before you can discover, but you probably have to go deliver before you can even explore, because that builds trust and competence. Once you can get that delivery engine cranking, now you've got the time to go and do the bigger picture stuff and start working on some discovery. And then eventually you need some exploration as your personal maturity. As an organization, you've got to explore first. But as an individual, you've probably got to discover deliver first, then start to do some discovery, and then eventually graduate into that exploration space.
Beautiful. You clearly read a lot, Phil. You have lots of different references across this episode. So I have to ask you, if you had to recommend one book to product folks that might be listening, what would that be? You have a library behind you.
Send response. Jeff Gothel and Josh Seiden. It's just my favorite book. It really gets the mindset of products across.
They're just amazing writers. I'm really looking forward to their new book coming up very soon. I think
April or May, I think, is what I've heard.
Yeah, cool. Nice. Phil, where can people find you? You mentioned, of course, your channel, Talking Roadmaps, YouTube channel. By the way, just want to mention to everyone listening, Phil has an insane lineup of guests, amazing people from, you know, all the names you've heard before. So please make sure you go there and watch all the episodes. I have taken note of the Itamar one. I really want to watch that one. But apart from Talking Roadmaps, Phil, and your LinkedIn, where can people find you? Is there any other place you're
So the other place to check me out would be forproductpeople.com. That's FOR, product people. So a little bit like for dummies, but everything I do is for product people. Not suggesting product people are dummies.
Amazing. Very good, Phil. It was so great to have you and so great to talk to you again. And I hope we can
talk to you again soon. It's been a pleasure.
All right, that was it for today. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Make sure you subscribe to my newsletter so you don't miss out, and see you next time.